The Guardian.
Hey, Matt Shore here. And before you get started with this episode of Chips with Everything, we wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything that you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, here's the show.
Hi. Why 140 characters?
That's a great question. So there's two reasons, one practical and one conceptual.
Hey, Matt Shore here, sitting in for Lee Alexander, who is away this week. And welcome back to another episode of Chips with Everything. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I spend way too much time trimming down my tweets. Trying to fit everything that you want to say into a measly 140 characters actually isn't that easy a lot of the time, and sometimes it actually feels impossible. That said, when Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey announced that the platform was considering increasing their 140-character limit to 10,000, the platform responded with a resounding no. Many argue that the character limit was what separated their beloved Twitter from other social media platforms like Tumblr or Facebook, for example, meaning their news, updates, ideas, and beliefs could be packaged and shared in bite-sized chunks.
Making sure that we had a very simple approach and simple experience, and that simplicity meant, in that case, that we would send one message.
But where did the character limit come from? And what can it tell us about the world that we live in? Coming up on this week's episode, we ask, 140 characters, a blessing or a curse?
Hello.
Hello, Dhiraj. Hi.
And who better to ask that question to than this guy?
Okay. I'm Dhiraj Murthy, Associate Professor of Journalism and Sociology at the University of Texas at Austin.
And in 2013, Dhiraj wrote a book called Twitter, Social Communication in the Twitter Age, arguably the world's first scholarly analysis of the platform and the role that it plays in our lives. And as Dhiraj explains,
the 140 characters comes from text messages. So that was the length of characters initially delimited by standard text messages, and still is used today. So Twitter became an extension of text messaging, and that's really its history in terms of where it originated from.
And so whilst this kind of technologically induced brevity is nothing new, Dhiraj does believe that it's an essential part of Twitter. And a reason why people reacted in the way that they did after Dorsey's announcement earlier this year.
I think brevity is a very important part of Twitter. The idea is you can quickly go to Twitter and be able to scan your feed and see what's happening, as opposed to some of the longer length communication that exists in Facebook, exists in blogs and Tumblr, exists in other parts of social media. So the whole idea of NetSpeak or having emojis or an LOL or a BTW or a Raffle or something very much kind of came into the spirit of Twitter's terse communication. I think that was a big thing that people thought, wait a second, that's all going to go. Whereas some of the beauty of Twitter was having all these people text you collectively and you being able to text people collectively as well. So those originating ideas, I think people did get up in arms about, but we've seen kind of as Twitter has matured that it's still been able to kind of retain some of those elements as well.
Somewhat surprisingly, this effect, which Dhiraj calls an electronically diminished turn to terseness, actually has quite a long history.
Well, I think it goes back since the start of communication technologies, really, and every technology has what we would call particular affordances, what they're designed to generally enable or disable. So the designers have kind of thought, well, I want this technology to try to encourage this sort of behavior or discourage that way. So there's always, in that way, been constraints with social communication technologies. If we think about the telephone, for example, it didn't distribute video, but it was very good at doing audio. But then some of the constraints were, what if you got your telephone call at the wrong time? Someone may not actually answer the phone. So some of these constraints are actually built into the design. Others may be politically, economically, or socially motivated in terms of their actual usage.
But what about outside the world of technology? Are we as people living in societies that favor this kind of brevity in everyday life?
It's kind of tempting for us to say, oh, you know, social media, Twitter, it's made us all terse. But we've always had terse communications depending on context. So if you're asking people for directions and saying, you know, is that Costa Coffee up ahead? People aren't going to go and give you this long exegesis back. They're going to say, yeah, just up, you know, to the left. So in some situations and contexts, terseness has always been acceptable. But things also change in terms of media. So if we think about email, when email first came out, people used to be more verbose because we weren't necessarily sending a lot of email. But as traffic has gone up and also our devices have changed, I'm thinking here smartphones, some people have, for example, at the end of a message sent from their smartphone, please excuse the shortness of this email, it was sent from my phone. And the recipient is kind of duly warned that verbose or long-length communication is not to be expected, you know, given that it's coming from a smartphone. So in some ways, as our technologies have changed, there's become a greater acceptability of non-verbose communications in some contexts. We know that person is using their iPad, or we know they're using a phone, or we've just got a lot of email traffic from them. So a quick thank you or can you explain that is sufficient, kind of like the directions.
And this key issue is something that we'll return to later on in the episode, the issue of whether it's technology shaping society or indeed society influencing technology itself. But whatever direction the influence is flowing in, it's pretty hard to argue against the massive impact that Twitter and other social media platforms are having on our everyday lives. And nowhere is this dynamic between our behaviors and these technologies more apparent than in the world of politics.
Yes.
Amazing. So
this is Lori Rice.
I'm Lori Rice, an associate professor of political science at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
We're recording it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And as Lori explains, the brevity of Twitter and its 140 character limit lends itself well to the world of politics.
Politicians are already used, and speechwriters are already used to thinking about how do you express something in a very short amount of time. So as they're thinking about the television era, they're thinking about, you know, how can I produce a soundbite that's going to make it to the local news? And those sorts of soundbites translate easily to Twitter. So it's not necessarily a brand new skill that they have to develop. But they do have to think about what's going to connect with people on Twitter, what's going to get people to want to like a tweet or want to retweet it.
And while it's commonplace now for politicians to be active on Twitter, the trend started with one Barack Obama almost 10 years ago.
He saw something that at the time most other politicians weren't seeing. He saw this potential to reach people, to engage people, and to get them involved in politics. Once people saw his success at using social media as a tool to mobilize supporters, to get them to take action, whether it was knocking on doors, whether it was reaching out to their contacts, but once politicians saw that potential, everybody realized you can't forgo social media. And so we've seen politicians trying to get a presence on just about every form of social media that has any kind of significant user base.
And from that point on, social media platforms became an increasingly vital component of a person's political presence. Cue Donald J. Trump.
I'm going to do very restrained. I find it tremendous. It's a modern form of communication. There should be nothing you should be ashamed of. It's where it's at.
Well, I think he, through The Apprentice and other things with reality television, really developed a good kind of sense of what would get people engaged, what would get people riled up, what would draw people's attention. And he took those kind of skills and he put them to use on Twitter in ways that were really good at drawing him the attention of average ordinary voters, but also the attention of traditional media. And so he was able to drive a tremendous amount of news coverage through tweets that were often outrageous and perhaps purposely so, because they would make a good story. And I think he had a good handle on what would make a good story.
And with over 16.4 million followers, Twitter provided the perfect platform for a man well-versed in attention-seeking.
I am your voice.
something made all the more emphatic by the 140 character limit.
You can't go into a lot of depth in 140 characters. And so, you know, you're talking about things at a surface level, and that's pretty easy to compose and to think about things that will really grab people's attention.
In this way, Donald Trump was almost made for Twitter, made for a world of 140 character limits, and he hasn't disappointed. Even as president-elect, the tweets keep coming, seemingly on a 24-hour-a-day basis. And arguably a huge part of his success, Trump's use of Twitter and other social media platforms to reach the disenfranchised, the frustrated, and the forgotten, was on par, if not better, than Obama's use of it a decade before. But this doesn't just come from the terse nature of tweeting. And after this short break, we'll hear about another Twitter-related phenomenon that may have played an equally important role in Trump's success.
If you're not communicating with people with different political views, then it becomes very easy to make it, you know, some kind of epic struggle against good versus evil.
We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Hey everyone, before we kick off the episode again, I wanted to recommend another great show that we produce here at The Guardian called Politics Weekly. Like me, if you've ever wanted to sound intelligent about a topic that you have no business understanding, then this show is definitely for you. Again, it's called Politics Weekly. You can find it on theguardian.com/podcasts or search for Politics Weekly on your favorite podcasting app or on iTunes. Now, back to the show.
I do believe this. I really believe that the fact that I have such power in terms of numbers with Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc., I think it helped me win all of these races where they're spending much more money than I spent. And I won.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Matt Shore. And before the break, we heard from Dhiraj Murthy about the so-called technological turn to terseness on Twitter and about how it might not be so technologically induced after all. We also heard from Lori Rice about the suitability of Twitter's 140-character limit to Donald Trump's own character, real or campaign-created. But it's not just Twitter's character limit that might have led to his success. In a truly polarized world, this taps into something that's way bigger than Twitter, and bigger than, dare I say it, the election of Donald Trump. It's a phrase that's become all too familiar in the preceding months. That phrase is echo chambers.
I think a lot of people initially, when Twitter came out, had a lot of hopes that there was going to be a lot of crosstalk and people coming from diverse positions were going to be interacting with each other. As social media has grown and matured more, in many ways, it's echoing how we as humans communicate. And that's often, in sociology, we call it homophily, or birds of a feather flock together. So actually, like-minded people are tending to speak with each other on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, etc. So they're talking mostly amongst themselves with like-minded interlocutors. And we see this again in the cases of Brexit and the US presidential election, where, you know, Clinton supporters, they were on their Twitter feeds and they weren't seeing lots of Trump tweets, or, you know, people who were anti-Brexit were seeing the anti-Brexit message. So I do think Twitter is very good at having echo chambers, but we're very good as humans of having those echo chambers. I kind of, being in the U.S. after the Trump election and hearing people say, I never met anyone who was going to vote for Trump. And then all of a sudden, you know, people come out of the woodwork and start talking about it. So I think that's a really good example of that.
So these echo chambers, whether technologically imposed or not, not only create divisions, but as Lori Rice points out, they create narratives to support those divisions.
If you're not communicating with people with different political views, then it becomes very easy to make it, you know, some kind of epic struggle against good versus evil, or, you know, that the future of the world is at stake, and we get kind of this overinflated view of the importance and of the differences between it, rather than seeing, you know, where there might be some common ground politically.
Highlighted by a Pew Research Center survey in the midst of the recent U.S. presidential election, they found that the 2016 campaign unfolded against a backdrop of, quote, intense partisan division and animosity, unquote, with views of the opposing party being more negative than at any point in nearly a quarter of a century. And social media platforms like Twitter play a huge role in that. Speaking to both of our experts, Dheeraj and Lori, about what we can now do to try and reverse this trend, the answers aren't particularly straightforward. They both point to a responsibility of the platforms themselves to do what they can, but they also both allude to the fact that much of the responsibility comes down to the individual. And as it turns out, individuals don't like to change a whole lot of the time. But again, it kind of gets you thinking about whether these successful technologies are shaping our society or whether they're successful because they align with the shape of our society.
Oftentimes we think that the technology is really shaping us, is controlling us. But really, I think the technology is shaped in our own image, and that contemporary social media is very much a product of our own needs, wants, desires, and identities, rather than the other way around, which sometimes we kind of pitch it in that. And I think it's tempting to say that social media has made us into this or that, but ultimately we've made social media. It's ours, it's our creation.
And if Twitter is indeed a reflection of our society, what does the success of their 140 character limit say about us?
I think we want things to be quick. We want them to be easy. We like things being instant. And so we can express ourselves in 140 characters. It doesn't take a whole lot of time to sit and compose a tweet that we're happy with. So I think it just shows where we are in society, how busy we are, how overwhelmed we are with all of the things that we're juggling. But we still want to be connected in some way to people. We still want to have a voice, and so that 140 characters allows us to do that.
But this is something Dheeraj doesn't agree with wholeheartedly. Again, looking back to history.
So I think many people perceive a feeling that the present age is over-focused on things happening in the moment, and they think that this is something unique to the present age. But it really isn't. As society is modernized over time in terms of technical innovation, historically, people have always had the feeling that we've been more in a now or in the moment society. So, you know, when the telegraph has come out or the telephone or any social communication technologies that have been quite revolutionary, it's really made people feel that. So I think it's really important to remember that when, you know, these sort of social communication technologies came into existence, it made those people think they were in a presentist or now-oriented society as well. So it isn't something unique to us. But at the same time, again, it's a change to the sort of volume as well as speed and richness that we had in the past. So I think it's that development or step change in terms of technical innovation that we feel uniquely places us in a presentist society. Even those people in the past with innovation such as the telephone and the telegraph felt they were very much living in a transformative now society.
But whether you like it or not, Twitter's 140 character limit is here, and it is here to stay, for now at least. But with everything we've heard, is it a blessing or is it a curse?
I think it's both. So on the positive side, on the blessing side of it, it has drawn a lot of people into politics who wouldn't ordinarily participate. In my own research, seen it's drawn a lot of millennials and young adults. It's drawn a lot of African-American young adults in particular. They find their voice on Twitter and it doesn't stop there. So if young adults tweet about politics, they become more likely to engage in all sorts of activities, both online and offline, that are political in nature. So in that aspect, the way that it's helped mobilize people, empower people, I think it's a really positive thing that Twitter has brought to the table. But there's a curse of it as well, because it lends itself in 140 characters to fairly shallow conversation, perhaps to more provocative views, to things that will get attention rather than things that will invite a deep and a meaningful conversation about politics.
Oh, I think it's definitely a blessing. If you say that something is 140 characters in terms of a text message or in terms of a tweet, there is a very low effort that's associated, at least in our minds, when we go to post a tweet. So looking at, for example, some of the tweets directed to Donald Trump after his election, people have been expressing their views, and it's 140 characters. So they say, whatever, we're going to tweet at real Donald Trump. And that's been, I think, interesting to see that sort of engagement in that sphere. Or if you're not happy with a company, you'll send them a tweet. Or if you think a journalist has got something wrong, you'll send them a tweet. So I think in that way, and it connects with the dialogue of democratization, we're opening up a channel of communication because it's viewed as low stakes. We don't have to sit and think we have to write pages to this person. We can just fire out a quick tweet and get our point of view across.
That's all for this week's show. Huge thanks to Dheeraj Murthy and Lori Rice for coming on. And if you want to read more about the subject, we'll include a link to Dheeraj's book in the show's description on The Guardian's website. This week's episode of Chips with Everything was presented by me, Matt Shore. I'm on Twitter at MattShore, and produced by Max Sanderson. He's on Twitter at MaxJSanderson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.